We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, the home of WILL AM, FM, and TV, made possible by a gift from Alice and Robert Campbell. Good morning. This is Focus 580. It's our telephone talk program, our morning talk program, I should say. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about our notions of human intelligence and how those notions relate to the challenges of education. Our guest for this hour is Howard Gardner, a Harvard scholar whose research on developmental psychology points to a more complex model of human intelligence than the model prevailing in our educational system. Dr. Gardner is well known for his theory of multiple intelligences, which challenges the notion that there exists only one kind of intelligence that can be measured, for example, with standard IQ tests. Rather, he says, each person has a set of intellectual abilities that can work individually or in concert with their other faculties. Among the intelligences Dr. Gardner has identified is one he has termed musical intelligence, and he'll be speaking on that subject during an upcoming conference on the campus of the University of Illinois. The conference will be held next week, specifically June 3rd through the 5th, at the School of Music on the Urbana campus of the University of Illinois. It is organized by the U of I College of Fine Arts and Applied the College of Fine and Applied Arts, and the School of Music's Division of Music Education and Council for Research, to give them due credit, and will be presented to commemorate the contributions of the late Marilyn Zimmerman to the field of music education. Dr. Zimmerman was a member of the U of I Music Education faculty from 1984 to 1995 and was very much involved with these issues. The keynote address at that conference will feature our guest, Howard Gardner, and will take place next Thursday, June 3rd, at 7 p.m. at the Smith Music Hall, and that is free and open to the public. So if you'd like to attend, you should feel free to do so. For the keynote address, Dr. Gardner will talk about music in the family of human intelligence. And during this hour, we'll talk with Howard Gardner about that and about the theory of multiple intelligences and what it means for improving the way we do education. As we talk with Howard Gardner, you are invited into the conversation. Questions are welcome. All we ask is you try to stay on our topic and accommodate as many people as possible, so we'll try to keep the show moving. You can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Anywhere else you can hear us, 800-222-9455, anytime during our conversation. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Howard Gardner is the John H. and Elizabeth A. Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He also holds positions as Adjunct Professor of Psychology at Harvard University, Adjunct Professor of Neurology at the Boston University School of Medicine, and he's also co-director of the Harvard Project Zero. Dr. Gardner is the author of 18 books, including his 1983 book, Frames of Mind, in which he introduced the theory of multiple intelligences. His latest book, just published by Simon & Schuster, is The Disciplined Mind, What All Students Should Understand, and it explores a wide range of issues involved in education and school reform. Before we use up the rest of the hour with this introduction, let's say hello to our guest. Dr. Gardner, good morning. Hello, Dr. Gardner.
Hi, good morning. Nice to hear you.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for spending the time with us.
Right.
To begin with, I've sort of hinted at the meaning of your theory of multiple intelligences, but could you give us a bit fuller explanation?
It's helpful to contrast my theory with the standard view of intelligence, which has been with us for almost a century, and that is intelligence is a single capacity or trait that people have. We have it in greater or lesser amounts. There isn't much about you can do to change your intelligence, so to speak. It's in your genes. And then psychologists can tell you how smart you are by giving you tests, usually paper and pencil kinds of tests. And even though people have been hacking at this theory for a long time, it seems to be very robust, and most people still hold on to it. A book called The Bell Curve a few years ago was kind of a celebration of this standard view. But about 20, 25 years ago, based on my own research about the brain and in lots of studies that I reviewed from a range of fields, including psychology and anthropology and neurology, I came to the conclusion that the theory was scientifically misleading, inadequate, and, to put it bluntly, wrong. And what I believe, and I've tried to collect a lot of evidence in support of this belief, is the human mind and the human brain are better thought of as a number of relatively independent faculties or capacities, which I've decided to call intelligences. Initially, I thought there were seven. Now I think there are eight or nine, and there's no absolute limit on the, on, how many intelligences there are. I have a set of criteria drawn from different disciplines, which allows me, I believe, to discriminate between something which ought to be called an intelligence and something which ought not to be. Mm. Anyway, that's the background, and I guess I owe you a list of what the intelligences are.
Well, it might be useful to talk about it, you know, at least some of them, to give some examples.
Right. Well, usually when we use the word intelligence, we're talking about what it means to do well in school. And in most societies, school rely very heavily on two intelligences, linguistic intelligence and logical mathematical intelligence. And I have no quarrel with the importance of these intelligences, and you're very lucky if you have good linguistic and good logical mathematical intelligence, because as long as you stay in school, people will think you're smart. If you ever walk out on the street, you discover there are other intelligences which are important as well. And the ones that I've enumerated so far are musical intelligence, which is the subject of the conference next week at the U of I, spatial intelligence, which is the capacity to form mental representations of wide space, the kind that you need if you're a pilot or a navigator or anybody else who has to see the big picture, but also aspects of spatial intelligence are much more local, the intelligence of a chess player or a surgeon or a sculptor, people who work with the space right in front of them. A fifth kind of intelligence I call bodily kinesthetic. It's the intelligence of the performer, the dancer, the athlete, the craft person, anybody who uses their whole body or parts of the body to solve problems or to make something. I believe there are two kinds of intelligence particularly tied to being a human being. Interpersonal intelligence is understanding of other human beings, and intrapersonal understanding is understanding of yourself. Many people listening will know about Dan Goleman's work on emotional intelligence,
sure.
And that really is quite similar to my notion of personal intelligences. An eighth intelligence I call the naturalist intelligence. It's the intelligence of a Darwin or an Audubon, somebody who can readily make distinctions in the world of nature between one animal and another, between one plant and another, between cloud configurations, anything that exists in nature. And there may be a ninth intelligence, a kind of intriguing one called the existential intelligence, the intelligence which allows us to ask big questions like who are we and what are we doing and what's it all about? Why do we have music? I would call that an existential question. And the theory has two interesting claims. The first claim is all of us have these intelligences. As it were, they're a way of talking about what the human cognitive apparatus is all about. It's as if, because of evolution, we have 8 or 9 different information processing devices which deal with language, music, space, and other kinds of elements in the world. The second claim is that no two people, not even identical twins, have exactly the same blend or combination or mosaic of intelligences. So you and I may have the same intelligences, presumably we do, but you might be stronger in linguistic, I might be stronger in spatial, and we can change our strengths by working very hard at them, but probably each of the strengths has a certain biological, indeed genetic, basis to it. So that in brief is what the theory of multiple intelligences claims. I put it forth as a theory of psychology because I am a psychologist. What I hadn't anticipated is the theory has encountered a lot of interest among educators, first in this country and now in other countries. People try to devise pedagogy or curriculum or assessment around the idea of multiple intelligences. It's very interesting to see the kinds of innovations that people have come up with when they say to themselves, look, if we've got all these different intelligences, how can we mobilize them to help kids learn or anybody learn better?
Right. And it's interesting because, you know, if you talk to teachers, they will tell you that in any given classroom, there are children with widely different abilities or inclinations or seemingly intelligences, as you would put it. And the problem they face is that they're supposed to present the curriculum in a way that brings the whole class along on one given track, but it may not match the inherent abilities of each student or it may not be appropriate for each student.
Well, that's a wonderful segue into the book of mine, which was just published this month, called The Disciplined Mind, where I argue that what we really want to have students acquire by the end of school is a sense of what it's like to think in a disciplined way, to think scientifically, to think historically, to think artistically. And we have a lot of evidence that even kids who get good grades in school don't really learn to think in those ways. And so the argument that I put forth in The Disciplined Mind is that if we try to cover less material in the curriculum and instead went into the topics that we do cover more deeply, we would really have a better chance of helping students understand. And when you begin to spend time on things, that's when you can mobilize the different intelligences. If you only got 5 minutes to cover a topic, or indeed only a day, you're probably going to present it in one way, usually in writing or in lecture. But if you're willing to spend days, even weeks on a topic, then you can present it pictorially, graphically, dynamically. You can act it out. You can approach it numerically. You can approach it in terms of what I call these existential questions. And not only will you reach more kids, because kids have different, shall we say, strong suits intellectually, but you also give kids a sense of what it's like to understand something, because anything a person understands well, he or she can think about in lots of different ways. If you think about yourself, your family, your home, your job, your hobby, you're not restricted to just think about it in words or just think about it pictorially. You can think about it in a number of different ways. So the irony is that the fact of our multiple intelligences actually allows us to achieve much better understanding of something than if we only had one way of making sense. I've actually even thought that perhaps the reason that human beings are conscious and other organisms are not conscious in the same way that we are is because we are able to represent things in different ways. And when we can think about something in more than one way, it sort of makes us notice what it is that how our mind works. But that's a theory of consciousness, which is very speculative.
Mm-hmm. Returning just a moment to the theoretical construct of multiple intelligences, I'm thinking of certain stereotypes we have about people who, for example, are very good at math. Stereotypical computer geek or technically oriented person who could even be a genius with numbers, but who is socially inept. We seem to have this notion that there are inherent trade-offs between these different areas of intelligence. Do you think that there's some truth to that, or is that simply a notion that it may be true in some cases, but it isn't universal?
It certainly isn't universal. I'm very suspicious of yoking any strength in one intelligence to a strength or a weakness in another. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people say that musical and mathematical intelligence are connected, but I'm pretty skeptical about that. My own analysis of that is that that mathematicians are interested in patterns, and music is a wonderful playground for patterns. Mm-hmm. So they get very intrigued by all the numbers and rhythms and pulses that they can extract from a musical score. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to work the other way around. There isn't a high correlation between people who are musical and perform well and so on and any particular interest in math. If you doubt that, I would invite you to go to the Chicago Symphony and circulate math books among the performers. I don't think you'd find it particularly interesting to them. The disjunction that you're claiming, I think, does have a certain interest, though I don't think we really have strong evidence about it. One of the things I've written about all the way back to Frames of Mind is that there is a kind of a rough division among people who are particularly interested in objects and patterns on the one hand, and people who are interested in human beings on the other. And as early as 2 or 3, you can see kids who love to do puzzles and who love to count and stuff like that, and other kids who are much more interested in stories and in games of hide-and-seek, where the human element is strong. And, of course, we all know that there's one condition called autism, which is a frank dysfunction in the human realm, which is sometimes, though not always, combined with a very strong patterning in music or mathematics or space or something like that. And so it may be the case that, at least in some people, there's what you would call a syndrome, biologically based, which orients them very much toward the world of patterns and not toward the world of human beings. And then we have the opposite situation in individuals who have Down syndrome, where their big problem is dealing with symbols and manipulating them, but they are often socially very appropriate. But I would not want any listener to go beyond the notion that sometimes we have these interesting patterns. I don't think there's anything that's at all ineluctable about them. Most people who are interested in math are perfectly civil. They are able to get along with other people. They may actually find math more interesting, but that's fine.
Well, very good. We have several callers. In fact, our lines are filling up fast, so I want to go on and include as many people as we can. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking during this hour with Howard Gardner. He's a professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he's the originator of the theory of multiple intelligences. And we're talking this morning with him by telephone. He'll be in Champaign-Urbana next Thursday evening, and we'll be talking at 7 p.m. at Smith Music Hall about musical intelligence. So if you'd like to attend, you can do that. And we have several callers, so let's go on and include them. First, we have a listener on a car phone on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes, that's you.
Sorry, I didn't realize. I first just want to say this is a very interesting theory, and I actually quite like it myself. I wonder if you could kind of relate in how it would affect education in public schools or in just schools in general. I know when I was in school, I found it very hard to pay attention, for example, and I found in time that I have a very high musical inclination, and I'm also very math-oriented, which is actually kind of is stereotypically not associated with each other. And I was just wondering if you could comment on how this could affect teaching, and also kind of related to that, how our society is kind of focused on testing, saying, well, this person is good here, or just testing in general, saying that this student does fit up to our guidelines or our goals, and this student doesn't. I was wondering if you could comment on that as well, and I'll hang up and listen to your answers.
Okay. Well, actually, the caller has raised two of the issues, which I'm sure other people are interested in as well. As to the first question, how has this affected teaching? There have been an enormous number of experiments all over where people try to use, what we'll say at least for this program, the fact of multiple intelligences to improve their education. And I think it's taken two primary forms. The first form is to make sure that we have each day or each week activities and lessons which, so to speak, marshal or nourish the different intelligences. I mean, very easy to have a school where all you did was talk, and then a lot of intelligences are being neglected. So one use has been to, as it were, enrich or vary the curriculum. The other, which is what I write about in The Disciplined Mind, is to approach topics in a way that mobilizes more than one intelligence. In The Disciplined Mind, I talk about three topics: the theory of evolution, the music of Mozart, and the Holocaust. And each of those topics are worth spending time on. And if you do spend time on them, you can present them through stories, you can present them through works of art, you can have kids do hands-on kinds of activities, you can have them do group activities. And not only does that involve more kids, but it gives kids a sense of what it's like to really understand those topics. So those two ways, one, broaden the curriculum, two, teach stuff in a number of ways, are the two principal ways in which education has been affected by the theory. As for testing, I'm sure the caller and others know that's a huge can of worms nowadays in America. It's very politicized. I think that we do way more testing in this country than anywhere else, and there's no particular evidence that the testing itself does any good. In fact, a book I'm just reading now, which will come out next year, shows the more testing that's done in states, the poorer the states perform. And I think that's a very interesting kind of correlation because, of course, it goes exactly against what policymakers have to say. That said, I'm certainly a person who's in favor of assessing. I think in any domain, including education, it's very important to know how people are doing, and the only way you can know is to have them perform their understandings or their non-understandings. And I use those words quite deliberately. I think that performing is something you should do publicly, and simply filling in blanks is a very low form of performing. And understanding means not just that you've memorized something and have to regurgitate it back, which I think the caller was referring to, but rather that you can stretch what you've got, that you can put it to new uses. If you've understood the Holocaust, you should be able to analyze what's going on in Rwanda or in Kosovo in a way that you wouldn't if you didn't have an understanding of other kinds of genocide. Similarly, if you understand something about evolution, you can participate in a discussion about artificial life, which is now being created in computers, in ways in which that's unlike or unlike natural selection. However, if you've just taken a cultural literacy curriculum where you say, okay, kids, we've had our 5 minutes on the Holocaust, let's go on to the Holy Graham or the Hologram or the Holy Ghost or something like that, then, of course, you're not going to be able to stretch that information. It's what Alfred North Whitehead called inert knowledge. It just kind of sits there like a Christmas tree ornament with no Christmas tree to hang it on. So those are some thoughts on how I would go about assessing. I also, just to make one more point, don't particularly like the idea of going around and measuring people's intelligences per se. I'd much rather say, what's an activity that we think is important? Let's see how people are doing on that activity. Let's see if we can help them do better. So rather than measuring somebody's mathematical intelligence, I'd rather say, look, here are some of the things you need to be able to do to survive in our culture mathematically, being able to shop, being able to plan a mortgage, something like that, and see how people do with that rather than assuming that you can somehow measure this abstract entity called mathematical intelligence.
Well, very good. We have another caller waiting, and we'll go to them next. And just to mention for other folks who are listening, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you're listening, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. First of all, say that your work seems to match what I've intuitively believed for a very long time. I should know if you're familiar with the work of Paul Parasol. Had a number of books recently, The Heart's Code, and also the work of Dr. Linda Russick, who's a research psychologist at Harvard, and also a co-director of the Human Energy Systems Laboratory and energy medicine at University of Arizona.
I'm not doing too well on this test of cultural.
Okay. Well, the reason
maybe you should tell the listeners
why
you brought them up. Okay.
They talk about the heart as an intelligent organ.
Oh yes. Okay. I do recognize that. Okay. I understand. I don't think I can comment scientifically on that. I have to say it sounds a bit weird to me. Clearly, we need the heart and the brain together for any kind of cognition or emotion to take place. And we don't have to do the experiment. We know that if we remove either, not much is going to go on. But I don't feel I can give a scientific account of that work.
I was just wondering if you deal with probably you don't, since you find this weird, but they would say that the brain often overrules the intelligence of the heart, but that if you'd learn to allow that to do some of your thinking, that you'd be a lot better off, and that it is actually an intelligent organ.
Okay. Well, certainly, I have no problem with using the heart metaphorically, as you do, and I quite agree.
Well, they don't use it metaphorically.
I know, but I'm saying when you begin to use it literally, then I don't feel I can comment on it scientifically. I just don't understand enough about the cardiac system and how it works.
Well, that's some of the research they're going into and dealing with cellular memory.
Right.
And actually recovering memories of the donor in the recipient. They've had instances where somebody who's received a heart transplant actually recovering the memory owner.
Yep. Well, part of being a scientist is being very skeptical and very conservative. So this is intriguing, but I suppose somebody like me would have to be convinced a lot of people think that this is plausible because it sounds so counterintuitive. But you and I both know that sometimes counterintuitive things have been shown to be correct. So that's why I don't want to comment on it scientifically. I'm way too far away from that issue.
Well, you might want to look into that.
Okay, well, I appreciate the suggestion.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Okay. Well, it does bring to mind, though, a question that I had, and this is, as it relates to your model of multiple intelligences, the concept of empathy for other humans, and this is something perhaps might be regarded as part of interpersonal intelligence.
Right. Empathy is actually an issue that I've discussed with Dan Goleman on the air. Dan Goleman is the author of the well-known book on emotional intelligence, and one of his criteria of emotional intelligence is empathy, the fact that you can empathize with others. And there's no question to me that part of interpersonal intelligence is being able to put yourself in the mindset of somebody else. Where I have more trouble is knowing whether you actually have to sort of feel the way that they do, and even more, whether the fact that you feel the way they do will dictate how you behave toward them. We talked about Hitler, and Dan Goleman said, of course, Hitler couldn't have any empathy. And I said, well, it depends how you define empathy. If you mean, could he figure out how other people were thinking and feeling, I think the answer is quite clearly yes. But whether that was able to prevent him from doing things which are antisocial, the answer is clearly no. And to capture that, I quote a well-known stupid joke, which is that the masochist says, hit me, and the sadist says, I will not, because the sadist knows that being hit is what the masochist likes. So in one sense, he's empathetic. He can put himself into the masochist's body, but on the other hand, playing his role as a sadist, he's just not going to hit him. And Dan Goldman would say he lacked empathy, and I might say, well, maybe he doesn't lack empathy, he just doesn't want to act on the basis of it. But to return to your question, certainly understanding how other people would think about a situation and feel about a situation is a very important part of interpersonal intelligence, and it's something which a lot of us worry about in this post-Littleton era.
Well, so a point that Richard Rorty makes about empathy is it involves imagination. It involves placing ourselves in the shoes of someone as if what they are experiencing is, you know, what we might experience, and we can identify and see ourselves as that other person. And the, you know, his point is that this is something that we lack a great deal of in this very fast-paced world, that we lack the capacity or perhaps even the time to imagine each other in that sense. And I guess my question comes to the point of where imagination fits into these issues of intelligence and, you know, interpersonal relations and maybe interpersonal intelligence.
Right. Well, I have a general approach to issues of what's often called human faculties, like memory, perception, learning, imagination, and intuition. And the general approach is that I am suspicious of these as being traits which cut across a wide range of contents. What I would rather believe, and I think there's some scientific evidence in favor of this, is that each form of intelligence, as it were, has its own set of faculties. So to be specific, there's a linguistic memory, there's a musical memory, there's a spatial memory, and you could be good in remembering locations but not particularly remember musical works or vice versa. Similarly, I think each intelligence has its own form of imagination, which very literally means being able to conjure up entities in their absence. So if you have a good spatial imagination, you can think about the spatial arrangement when you're not there, and you can play around with it in your own mind, and so on. If you have a good musical imagination, you can create and play around with musical forms. And again, I don't think there's any particular reason why having good imagination in one realm would dictate or not dictate good imagination in other realms. If you have interpersonal imagination, which I guess many of us use without thinking about it, you're able to imagine what it's like to be in conversation with someone else, to see things from their point of view. And, you know, we do it all the time when we rehearse in our mind what's going to happen when we have a dicey situation coming up. That's an exercising of interpersonal imagination. Now, you know, Rorty might also be using imagination in the much broader sense of what artists do, you know. Namely, you know, Picasso obviously had a very vivid imagination, and he captured it in painting and so on. And my guess is that when we use imagination in that broader sense, it might well involve a number of different intelligences working together. The intelligences are kind of like a toolkit or a chemistry set. They're what God or nature gave us for thinking with, but there's no particular restrictions on how we put them together.
Very good.
Nonetheless, what I would say is, if you say of somebody he or she has a good imagination or not much of an imagination, it's always useful to say, well, what's the example I have in mind, and could I assume that their imaginations would be equally strong in other areas?
Okay. Well, very good. We have a couple other listeners waiting to talk, so let's include them. Next up, a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. I had two questions. One, I was wondering if you've ever heard of the educator Deborah Meyer?
Sure. She's actually recently moved to Boston. She's a famous principal from New York City who did first elementary and then high schools, and now has begun in a primary school in Boston. She's a person whom I admire tremendously.
Yes, I do too. I particularly like her approach of wanting to instill particular habits of mind in kids. Things like looking for evidence, looking for another point of view, looking for connections between facts, asking what if this or that happened, and whether something really matters or not. But in thinking about what her approach and your approach, I was just wondering if just how much it is you have in common or are in conflict.
Okay, well, I can speak a bit about that without hopefully making it difficult for people who haven't read her to appreciate. She's a little bit suspicious of my notion of different kinds of intelligence because she's afraid it's going to be reified. That is, people are going to walk around and talk about Johnny has spatial intelligence and not linguistic or vice versa. And that's a danger which I worry about as well. When it comes to the topic of disciplines, which is my most recent book, I think that she probably would say the kinds of things that you said, namely using your mind well is what's important, and learning about specific disciplines may not be as important as I think it is. But I think on a practical level, we're pretty close, because I think we would both say that in high school, folks try to cover way too much, and we go make highly splintered judgments within disciplines. We have chemistry first year and physics second year and biology third year and so on. And what both Deborah Meyer and I would say is it's important to know what it means to think scientifically, but you can learn that from examining lots of sciences. You don't have to just do certain ones in certain orders. Or maybe a better way to put it, you can learn to think scientifically from examining any science. You don't have to keep piling on. So I would say that from any distance, Deborah Meyer and I are very similar. I've learned a tremendous amount from her. She really is a heroine of mine. But when you get up close, you know, we don't agree about everything, and she hasn't hesitated to say to me and in print where she disagrees.
Well, that's good to hear. Then
the second question?
The last question. I was curious about. I read an interview with Mr. Brockman, I think his name was.
Right.
Yeah.
Bob Brockman is a literary agent who's been instrumental in promoting intellectual discussion in print and on the internet among people who are interested in science and social science and literature.
Yeah, it was interesting to me because I've taught in high schools myself, and I get the feeling that apparently he had, and that is that
he's just a kid who finished high school. That might be part of it as well.
Excuse me?
I said you're talking about John Brockman, right?
Right.
Yeah, he just had his son just finished high school, so he's got that on the mind for as a father as well as a teacher.
Well, I was thinking, he seemed to think that you were a little bit ivory tower on the idea that this could help, this could be good for all kids. He was speaking of your new book.
Right. Well,
I'm thinking also from my own personal experience. For example, when you talk about, I think you call them entry points.
Yes.
To discussions that you can have in high school that would allow a deep, get the class involved deeply in important topics.
Yeah.
I think you kind of underestimate what kind of a breakout you'd have in the class. You seem to think that all kids could be captured this way, but it's really much more difficult than that. You must be, in particular, the thing I wanted to mention was that you really must be more current. Your topics have to be much more, have to start at least from a point very current, very something in.
I understand what you're saying, and let me try to respond to it. First of all, I am here trying to give a vision of what I would like education to be like, and I think we need people who are not afraid to put forth a personal vision, even though they don't believe that tomorrow everybody's going to drop what they're doing and adopt it. As I say at the beginning of The Disciplined Mind, we've had way too much talk about charters, vouchers, unions, all these instrumental things, and not enough talk about what is it about at the end of the day. And what Deborah Meyer and I are both trying to say is what's really important. And my book is written from that vantage point. However, I think something which maybe I haven't made clear enough is understanding of topics like evolution or Mozart or the Holocaust is where I want students to end. But the teacher has to use all the skills that he or she has in his or her possession to help the kids get there. And you always have to start with where the learner is. So in The Disciplined Mind, in starting about evolution, I start with an issue which I find very fascinating, namely, why in the Galapagos Islands, in a very small distance, do you have birds of different kinds of beaks? And why do birds of one kind of beak, are they on one island, and birds with another kind of beak on another island? And I think that's a good entry point for many students. I think they would find it interesting. But if you have students who find that alien, I'll tell you an evolution that I've never met a student who isn't interested in. That's the evolution of fashion. You know, how do clothing change from one year to the next? Why do cars change from one year to the next? And that would be an entry point for students who might even be determinedly anti-intellectual. But the point is, we don't have to have school to teach Star Wars or to teach rap music. Kids go to that anyway. School needs to start with what kids find interesting and then bring them to things which are important but they may not intrinsically find interesting. That's the art of teaching. And I do believe that while it's certainly harder in some places than others, and it's more difficult now than it was 50 years or 100 years ago, that if you don't believe it's possible, you shouldn't be in teaching.
Well, that's very good. I'll just make one quick comment, and then I'll get off. It's not really a question, but I think this you mentioned interpersonal skills as being a one of the 8 or 9 traits that people have. I think that one's a really hard nut to crack, and I wish you'd comment a little bit more about that. But thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Well, very briefly, I think the way that human beings learn about other human beings is through the interactions which they observe. And that's why in school, the nature of the community, how teachers relate to one another, how they relate to parents, how they relate to kids, that's the important message. And that determines whether you have an atmosphere which is comfortable and where people are empathic, or one which is competitive or antisocial. We all have the potential to go either way. There are some characters out of history, like Malcolm X, where you really could see them being pulled toward a more destructive or a more positive point of view. And, of course, literature is filled with characters who are tempted in both ways. But there's a tipping point at a certain point. And when kids are young, the encounters they have with other human beings are terribly important. And it's very, very sad when kids have no adults or older people whom they can admire. I was talking to a teacher of 12-year-olds in Indianapolis earlier this year. And he had a student who was quite difficult, wasn't a particularly good student, but he formed a relationship with a student. At the end of the year, the student said, "Mr. Smith, you are the first person in the world ever to say that you loved me." What an incredible thing that a kid could grow up to the age of 12 in this country and nobody ever said they loved them. But it's probably not the only kid who's had that experience.
Our lines are all full, and we're going to run out of time, I think, before we get to everyone, but we'll do our best. And let me just mention again that we're talking this morning during this hour of Focus 580 with Howard Gardner. He's professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And we're talking about his theory of multiple intelligences and sort of a sample of a lecture, or at least a hint of that he will be giving next Thursday evening, 7 p.m. at the Smith Music Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois. That's free and open to the public, so you should feel free to attend. Let's go on and include as many people as we can before we run out of time. Next listener in Champaign County, line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'll try to keep my questions brief here. I have maybe 2 interests. One is sort of your reaction to Rudolf Arnheim's visual thinking kind of process. How does that fit in with your, or where does that fit into your multiple intelligence?
Well, Rudolf Arnheim is an old friend, and I was lucky enough to be his student many years ago at Harvard. He's now a professor emeritus living in Ann Arbor and still writing and thinking at age of 95. So he's another hero of mine. He wrote a book about 30 years ago called Visual Thinking, which basically argued that cognition comes out of our sensory processes and that vision has a privileged position among that. And I think in doing so, he really called attention to something that I agree with, namely, if you only think about thinking or rationality or intelligence in terms of language and logic, you're missing a very important aspect of the mind. So I'm very sympathetic to the kinds of examples that he used in his book on visual thinking. What I would disagree is that I don't think that the visual intelligence is privileged over others. I think people just have different strengths which they use. And also, I think I have to say, in fairness to Rudolf Arnheim, who is a very old friend, I mean, we've known each other for almost 40 years, that he believes that there is a kind of intelligence which underlies all the different sensory organs. He believes there's a single underlying intelligence. And there, he and I don't agree. He believes that, you know, if people are intelligent, they are intelligent kind of across the board. And that's something that I don't agree with. if for you and other listeners who are interested in the psychology of this, Rudolf Arnheim is what's called a Gestalt psychologist. And Gestalt psychologists believe that basically the human mind is a pattern-forming kind of device, and that the visual patterns were privileged because of the nature of our species. And, of course, there's a lot of our brain is directed toward visual processing. I'm a couple of generations younger than Rudi Arnheim, and I'm much more sympathetic to an approach in psychology which is called modular. And that basically argues that the human mind isn't a single device. It's a number of relatively separate devices. I do think the preponderance of evidence is in favor of my position rather than Arnheim's, but I'm obviously not an unbiased observer, and he's a very wise man.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me bring this into a more contemporary kind of discussion of mental process then, and ask about your reaction to Richard Dennett's theory of consciousness.
You mean Dan Dennett's theory?
Yes, Dan Dennett, yeah.
Okay. Well, Dan Dennett is a very eminent philosopher interested in cognition who is a colleague of mine. He's in Boston at Tufts University. And Dan is in many ways a debunker. He says, you know, we think about consciousness in the sense there's a little guy inside the head looking out at a screen and making sense of things, and that this is a primitive way of thinking, and that we'd be better off to dispense with it. In doing so, I think he takes a position which many people, including me, have sympathy with. When I think about my own theory of intelligence, there's no little guy in there turning all the knobs and saying which intelligence should be working. Rather, we've got this machinery, and it just tries to make sense of things in the best way it can. But Dan is more of a critic than that. He questions the usefulness of consciousness in the sense that most of us think about it, namely a heightened state of perception where we're aware that we're aware. Some people have quipped, and Dan himself has recognized this quip, that Dan, unlike his title, hasn't really explained consciousness. He's explained it away. More generally, Dan Dennett is very nervous or impatient with anything that smacks of vitalism or agency or even things like intention. He says we have to treat people and machines as if they have intentions, as if they have feelings, as if they have beliefs. But that's just a way of thinking about it, that deep down it's just neurons talking to neurons and schemes talking to schemes, schemas talking to schemas. And that I'm not so terribly sympathetic to. I think that there's a lot of intelligence in folk psychology, and that the effort to, as it were, reduce everything to a non-intentional, non-conscious kind of language really, underestimates what's special about cognition.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
We have just about 5 minutes left with our guest, Howard Gardner, and we have a couple callers, and we'll try to get them both in. We'll talk next with a listener in Arcola on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. I did want to tell you that I think your work is very, very, very good. My husband teaches in Mattoon and has some other colleagues that are trying to use your material in the classroom, and they're having great success with this. My husband teaches history, and so I want to compliment you on your work, and he's found a lot of development in the students that was not coming forth. One of the more difficult things I think he's had to kind of encounter was that he teaches honors history, and one of the students who are extremely, quote, bright in the sciences and so forth, tend to have more trouble dealing with the other aspects of the intelligences, and they have no patience to deal with the more creative aspects such as the arts and the so forth when projects are presented with all aspects.
I think that this may be a very genuine phenomenon. There is a kind of panic in our country which is completely unrealistic, that somehow if we don't do the subjects and cover everything in it, that we will somehow never get to college, never get to life. It's completely nonsense. The country is on more of a roll than it's ever been in history. But many people still feel very nervous when they can't see the immediate utility of anything for getting a job or getting into Harvard. My view is that teachers are professionals. They have a calling. They have to believe that what they're doing is important, and they have to be able to defend what it is that they're doing. I don't think anybody should do multiple intelligences to please Howard Gardner. That would be ridiculous. But if you take a multiple intelligences point of view, you need to have a reason for it. You need to be able to explain it and explain it again. And if you have a good reason and you're pretty articulate, you can probably convince a lot of people. But it's not easy because both our policymakers and our media give what I call a Vanna White or Jeopardy view of the mind, namely the more stuff you shove in, the better, and anything that smacks of depth or beauty has to be dispensed with. It's a very sad situation, but I think you've got to fight it, and that's what I try to do in the disciplined mind.
Apologies to the caller, but we're running into our last couple of minutes, and we're just about the point we're going to have to stop. I did want to ask you to talk a little bit about the arts, because I find that music and the arts is mentioned very prominently in your work. Why is this so important to learn?
Well, it's not an accident, because, in fact, music is very important to me. I was a serious pianist as a young person. I taught piano for a while, and while I don't play much anymore, I sit for about an hour each day with my 13-year-old at the piano. I hope he likes it. I love it. And I think that the disciplines in general, and classical music in particular, are among the most wonderful inventions of human beings, which I sometimes forget their inventions. We take it for granted. But it's only an accident that we happen to have Bach and Mozart and the Beatles and Duke Ellington and Scott Joplin and people like that. It could very well never have been. These are the notion of creating harmony and writing music down and things like that. Those are all human inventions. So I want to say that at a time when we're re-examining everything, we really need to pay attention to those things which, over the long run, have given lots of pleasure and meaning to people. And for me, at least, music is very high on the list, and that's one reason I'm looking forward to coming to Urbana next week and talking with other people about musical intelligence.
Well, very good. We sort of hinted at that topic, but for those of you listening, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Howard Gardner, you can attend the keynote speech at this conference on cognitive processes of children engaged in musical activity, and that'll be next Thursday evening, 7 p.m. at the Smith Music Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana, and that's sponsored by the School of Music here. And so you can hear him speak on music in the family of human intelligences. Also, if you'd like to read more of Howard Gardner's work, you can look for his latest book, The Disciplined Mind, What All Students Should Understand, just published by Simon & Schuster. And our guest, Howard Gardner, once again, is a professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And I want to thank you very much for spending the time with us. It's been very interesting.
Good. I've enjoyed talking to you and the callers.
Thanks so much.
Right, bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millicom 99 program presents a series of informative events on the UIUC campus. All Millicom events are free and open to the public. More information is available by calling 333-1118 or visiting their website at www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is also made possible with support from Linda Sheets of REMAX Realty Associates, specializing in distinctive homes, a professional broker serving the needs of buyers and sellers in the Champaign-Urbana area. Linda invites you to join her in supporting public broadcasting. We'll leave it there for this hour. When we return in just a few minutes, we'll be talking with novelist Neal Stephenson. His latest is Cryptonomicon. He's also the author of Snow Crash, A Diamond Age, and Zodiac. Very interesting work, and we'll talk about that and give you a sample of that in just a few minutes. First, we'll take a break for some news and a market update.